Good evening, poor soul. It seems like you're desperate to find something to fall asleep to. And I'm having the same sort of troubles myself. So I'm going to read to you. This is a short story out of a larger book which won't be named, save as The Tale of the Man Who Was Too Lazy to Fail. Now, to set the scene, there are two characters in the far future. One a very, very old, revitalized man, and the other the head of government on the planet they are on in humanity's far distant future. We'll be calling them Lazarus and Ira, respectively. And Laz is telling Ira the story of one David Lamb. He was a schoolmate of mine in a school for training naval officers. Not Space Navy. This was before the human race had even reached Earth's one satellite. This was wet navy, ships that floated in water and attempted to sink each other, often with regrettable success. I got mixed up in this through being too young to realize, emotionally, that if my ship sank, I probably would sink too. But this is not my story, but David Lamb's. To explain David, I must go back to his childhood. He was a hillbilly, which means he came from an area uncivilized even by the loose standards of those days, and David came from so far back in the hills that the hoot owls trod the chickens. His education was in a one-room country school and ended at 13. He enjoyed it, for every hour in school was an hour sitting down doing nothing harder than reading. Before and after school, he had to do chores on his family's farm, which he hated, as they were what was known as honest work, meaning hard, dirty, inefficient, and ill-paid, and also involved getting up early, which he hated even worse. Graduation was a grim day for him. It meant that he now did honest work all day long, instead of spending a restful 6 or 7 hours in school. One hot day, he spent 15 hours plowing behind a mule, and the longer he stared at the south end of that mule, breathing the dust it kicked up and wiping the sweat of honest toil out of his eyes, the more he hated it. That night, he left home informally, walked 15 miles to town, slept across the door of the post office until the postmistress opened up the next morning, and enlisted in the Navy. He had aged 2 years during that night, from 15 to 17, which made him old enough to enlist. A boy often ages rapidly when he leaves home. The fact was not noticeable. Birth registrations were unheard of at that time and place, and David was 6 feet tall, broad-shouldered, well-muscled, handsome, and mature in appearance save for a wild look around the eyes. The Navy suited David. They gave him shoes and new clothes, and let him ride around on the water, seeing strange and interesting places, untroubled by mules and the dust of cornfields. They did expect him to work, though not as much, or as hard, as working on his family farm, and once he figured out the political setup aboard ship, he became adept at not doing much work while still being satisfactory to the local gods, namely, chief petty officers. But it was not totally satisfactory, as he still had to get up early, and often had to stand night watches and sometimes scrub decks and perform other tasks unsuited to his sensitive temperament. Then he heard about this school for officer candidates, midshipmen as they were known. Not that David cared what they were called. The point was that the Navy would pay him to sit down and read books. His notion of heaven, untroubled by decks to scrub and by petty officers. Well, David was ill-prepared for this school, never having had 4 to 5 years additional schooling considered necessary to enter it. Mathematics, what passed for science, history, languages, literature, and so forth. Pretending to 4 years or so of schooling he did not have was more difficult than tacking 2 years onto the age of an overgrown boy. But the Navy wished to encourage enlisted men to become officers. So it had established a tutoring school to aid candidates slightly deficient in academic preparation. David construed slightly deficient to mean his own state. He told his chief petty officer that he had just missed graduating from high school, which was true in a way. He had just missed by half a county, that being the distance from his home to the nearest high school. I don't know how David induced his CPO to recommend him. David never discussed this. Suffice to say that when David's ship steamed for the Mediterranean, David was dropped at Hampton Roads 6 weeks before the tutoring school convened. He was a supernumerary during that time. The personnel officer, in fact, his clerk, assigned David to a bunk and a mess and told him to stay the hell out of sight during working hours in the empty classrooms where his fellow hopefuls would meet 6 weeks later. David did so. The classrooms had in them the books used in tutoring, academic subjects a candidate might lack, and David lacked them all. He stayed out of sight, sat down, and read. That's all it took. When the class convened, David helped tutor in geometry, a required subject and perhaps the most difficult. 3 months later, he was sworn in as a naval cadet on the beautiful banks of the Hudson River at West Point. David did not then realize he had jumped from the frying pan into the fire. The sadism of petty officers is a mild hit-or-miss thing, compared with the calculated horrors visited on new cadets, plebes, by cadets of the senior classes, especially by the senior-most, the first-classmen, who were walking delegates of Lucifer himself in that organized hell. But David had 3 months to find this out and figure out what to do, that being the time the upperclassmen were on the briny practicing warfare. As he saw it, if he could last 9 months of these hazards, all the kingdoms of the earth would be his. So he said to himself, if a cow or a countess can sweat out 9 months, so can I. He arranged the hazards in his mind in terms of what must be endured, what could be avoided, and what he should actively seek. By the time the Lords of Creation returned to stomp on the plebes, he had a policy for each typical situation and was prepared to cope with it under doctrine, varying doctrines only enough to meet variations in situations, rather than coping hastily on an improvised basis. Now, I mean this is more important to surviving in tough situations than it sounds. For example, Gramp, David's grandpa, that is, warned him never to sit with his back to a door. "Son," he said to him, "might be 999 times you'd get away with it, no enemy of yours would come through that door. But the 1,000th time, that's the one that'll get you." If my own grandpa had always obeyed the rules, he might be alive today and still jumping out of bedroom windows. He knew better, but he missed just once through being too anxious to sit in on a poker game, and thereby took the one chair open, one with its back to a door, and it got him. He was up and out of his chair and emptied 3 shots from each of his guns into his assailant before he dropped. We don't die easy. But 'twas only a moral victory. He was essentially dead with a bullet in his heart before he got out of that chair. All from sitting with his back to an open door. Ira, I've never forgotten Gramp's words, and don't you forget them. So David categorized the hazards and prepared his doctrines. One thing that had to be endured was endless questioning, and he learned that a plebe was never permitted to answer, "I don't know, sir," to any upperclassman, especially a firstclassman. But the questions ordinarily fell into categories: history of the school, history of the Navy, famous naval ships, names of team captains and star players of various athletic sports, how many seconds till graduation, what's the menu for dinner? These did not bother him. They could be memorized, saved for the number of seconds remaining till graduation, and he worked out shortcuts for that, ones that stood him in good stead in later years. What sorts of shortcuts, Lazarus? Eh? Nothing fancy. A pre-calculated figure for reveille each morning, a supplementary number for each hour thereafter, such as 5 hours after 6 o'clock reveille, subtract 18,000 seconds from the base figure, and 12 minutes later than that, takes off another 720 seconds. For example, at noon formation, 100 days before graduation, say at exactly 12:01 and 13 seconds, figuring graduation at 10 a.m., which was standard, David could answer 8,632,727 seconds, sir, almost as fast as his squad leader could ask him, simply from having pre-calculated most of it. At any other time of day, he would look at his watch and pretend to wait for the second hand to reach a mark while in fact performing subtractions in his head. But he improved on this. He invented a decimal clock, not the one you use here on Secundus, but a variation on Earth's clumsy 24-hour day, 60-minute hour, 60-second minute system, then in vogue. He split the time for reveille to taps into intervals and sub-intervals of 10,000 seconds, 1,000 seconds, 100 seconds, and memorized conversion tables. You see the advantage. For anyone but Andy Libby, God rest his innocent soul, subtracting 10,000 or 1,000 from a long string of digits up in the millions is easier to do in your head, quickly and without error, than it is to subtract 7,273, the figure to be subtracted in the example I just gave. David's new method did not involve carrying auxiliary figures in the mind while searching for the ultimate answer. For example, 10,000 seconds after reveille is 8:46 a.m., Once David worked out his conversion tables and memorized, it took him less than a day. Just memorizing was easy for him once he had that down pat. He could convert to the 100-second interval coming up next almost instantly, then add, not subtract, two digits representing the time still to go to the last two places in his rough answer to get his exact answer. Since the last two places were always zeros, check it yourself, he could give an answer in millions of seconds, as fast as he could speak the figures and have it right every time. Since he didn't explain his method, he got a reputation for being a lightning calculator, an idiot savant talent like Libby. He was not. He was simply a country boy who used his head on a simple problem. But his squad leader got so groused at him for being a smartass, meaning that the squad leader couldn't do it, that he ordered David to memorize the logarithm tables. This didn't faze Dave. He didn't mind anything but honest work. He set out to do so, 20 new ones each day, that being the number this first classman thought would suffice to show up this smartass. The first classman grew tired of the matter when David completed only the first 600 figures, but Dave kept at it another 3 weeks through the first 1,000, which gave him the first 10,000 figures by interpolation, and made him independent of log tables, a skill that was of enormous use to him from then on, computers being effectively unknown in those days. But the unceasing barrage of questions did not bother Dave, save for the possibility of starving to death at mealtimes, and he learned to shovel it in fast while sitting rigidly at attention and still answer all questions flung at him. Some were trick questions, such as, "Mister, are you a virgin?" Either way a plebe answered, he was in trouble, if he gave a straight answer. In those days, some importance was placed on virginity, or the lack thereof. I can't say why. But trick questions called for trick answers. Dave found that an acceptable answer to that one was, "Yes, sir, in my left ear," or possibly his belly button. But most trick questions were intended to trap a plebe into giving a meek answer, and meekness was a mortal sin. Say a first classman said, Mister, would you say I was handsome? An acceptable answer would be, perhaps your mother would say so, sir, but not me. Or, sir, you are the handsomest man I ever saw who was intended to be an ape. Such answers were chancy. They might flick a first classman on the raw, but they were far, far safer than meek answers. But no matter how carefully a plebe tried to meet impossible standards, about once a week, some first classman would decide that he needed punishment, arbitrary punishment, without trial. This could run from mild, such as exercises repeated to physical claps, which David disliked as they reminded him of honest work, up to a paddling on the buttocks. This may strike you as nothing much, Ira, but I'm not speaking of paddling children sometimes receive. These beatings were delivered with the flat of a sword, or with a worn-out broom that amounted to a long, heavy club. Three blows delivered by a grown man in perfect health would leave the victim's bottom a mess of purple bruises and blood blisters, accompanied by excruciating pain. David tried hard to avoid incidents likely to result in this calculated torture, but there was no way to avoid them entirely short of quitting, as some first classmen awarded such blows through sheer sadism. David gritted his teeth and accepted them when he had to, judging, correctly, that he would be run out of the school if he defied the supreme authority of a first classman. So he thought about the south end of that mule, and he endured it. There was a much greater hazard to his personal safety and future prospects of a life free from honest work. The mystique of military service included the idea that a prospective officer must excel in athletic sports. Do not ask why. It was no more subject to rational explanation than is any other branch of theology. Plebes, in particular, had to, no choice, go out for sports. 2 hours each day, which were nominally free, David could not spend napping or dreaming in the quiet of the school's library, but must instead be spent in sweaty exercise. Worse still, some sports were not only excessively energetic, but also involved hazards to David's favorite skin. Boxing, this long-forgotten and utterly useless stylized mock combat in which two men batter each other for a preset period or until one is beaten unconscious. Lacrosse, this is a mock battle taken over from the savages who had formerly inhabited that continent. In it, mobs of men fought with clubs. There was a hard missile with which points were scored, but it was the prospect of being sliced open or having bones broken with these clubs that aroused our hero's distaste. There was a thing called water polo, in which opposing swimmers tried to drown each other. David avoided that one by not swimming more than well enough to stay in school, a required skill. He was an excellent swimmer, having learned at the age of 7 through being chucked into a creek by 2 elder cousins, but he concealed his skill. The sport with the highest prestige was a thing called football, and first classmen sized up each new group of victims for candidates who might be expected to excel, or learn to excel, in this organized mayhem. David had never seen it, but now he saw it, and it filled his peaceful soul with horror. As well it might. It involved two gangs of 11 men facing each other on a field and trying to move an ellipsoid bladder down the field against the opposition of the other gang. There were rituals and esoteric terminology, but that was the idea. It sounds harmless and rather foolish. Foolish it was, harmless it was not, as the rituals permitted the opposing gang to attack a man attempting to move the bladder in a variety of violent ways, the least of which was to grab him and cause him to hit the ground like a ton of bricks. Often, 3 or 4 hit him at once, and sometimes inflicted indignities and mayhems not permitted by the rituals, but concealed by the pile of bodies. Death was not supposed to result from this activity, but sometimes did. Injuries short of death were commonplace. Unfortunately, David had the ideal physique for success in this feetball. Height, weight, eyesight, fleetness of foot, speed of reflex. He was certain to be spotted by the first classmen on their return from mock sea battles and volunteered as a sacrificial victim. It was time for evasive action. The only possible way to avoid football was to be acceptably occupied with some other sport. He found one. Ira, do you know what swordsmanship is? Good. I can speak freely. This was a time in Earth's history when the sword had ceased to be a weapon after having been prominent for more than 4 millennia. But swords still existed in fossil form and retained a shadow of their ancient prestige. A gentleman was presumed to know how to use a sword, and...
Lazarus, what is a gentleman?
What? Don't interrupt, boy, you'll confuse me. A gentleman is... Well, now let me see. A general definition... My, you can think up some hard ones. Some said it was an accident of birth, that being a disparaging way of saying it was a trait genetically inherited. But that doesn't say what the trait is. A gentleman was supposed to prefer being a dead lion to being a live jackal. Me, I've always preferred to be a live lion, so that puts me outside the rules. You could say in all seriousness that the quality tagged by that name represents the slow emergence in human culture of an ethic higher than simple self-interest. Damn slow in emerging, in my opinion. You still can't rely on it in a crunch. As may be, military officers were presumed to be gentlemen and wore swords. Even flyers wore swords, though Allah alone could guess why. These cadets were not only presumed to be gentlemen, there was a national law which stated that they were gentlemen. So they were taught a bare minimum about how to handle a sword, just enough to keep them from slicing their fingers or stabbing bystanders. Not enough to fight with them, just to keep them from looking too silly when protocol required them to wear swords. But swordsmanship was a recognized sport called fencing. It had none of the prestige of football or boxing or even water polo, but it was on the list. A plebe could sign up for it. David spotted this way out. Under a simple physical law, if he was up in the fencing loft, then he was not down on the football field with sadistic gorillas in hobnail boots jumping up and down on him. Long before the upperclassmen returned from the briny, plebe cadet Lamb had established himself as a member of the fencing squad, with a record of never missing a day, and was trying very hard to look like a good prospect for the team. At that time and place, 3 forms of fencing were taught: saber, dueling sword, and foil. The first two used full-size weapons. True, edges were dulled and points were baited. Nevertheless, a man could get hurt with them, even fatally, though that was very rare. But the foil was a lightweight toy, a fake sword with a limber blade that bent at the slightest pressure. The stylized imitation swordplay that used the foil was about as dangerous as tiddlywinks. This was the weapon that David selected. It was made for him. The highly artificial rules of foil fencing gave great advantage to fast reflexes and a sharp brain, both of which he had. Some exertion was necessary, but not much compared with football, lacrosse, or even tennis. Best of all, it required no body-against-body pounding that David found so distasteful in the rough games he was avoiding. David applied himself single-mindedly to acquiring skill so that his haven would be secure. So diligent was he in protecting his sanctuary that before his plebe year was over, he was National Novice Foil Champion. This caused his squad leader to smile at him, an expression that hurt his face. The cadet's company commander noticed him for the first time and congratulated him. Success with the foil even got him out of some punishment beatings. One Friday evening, when he was about to be beaten for some imaginary dereliction, David said, "Sir, if it's all the same to you, I'd rather have twice as many swats on Sunday, because tomorrow we're fencing the Princeton plebe team, and if you do the job I know you can do, It might slow me up tomorrow. The first classman was impressed by this, because having the Navy win at any time and for any purpose and in anything took precedence by sacred law over anything else, even the righteous pleasure of beating a smart-ass plebe. He answered, "Tell you what, mister, report to my room after supper on Sunday. If you lose tomorrow, you'll get a double dose of the medicine you've got coming to you. But if you win, we'll cancel it." David won all three of his matches. Fencing got him through his perilous plebe year, with his precious skin unmarked save for scars on his bottom. He was safe now, with three easy years ahead of him, for only a plebe was subject to physical punishment. Only a plebe could be ordered to take part in organized mayhem. One body contact sport David loved, one of ancient popularity, which he had learned back in those hills he had fled from, but it was played with girls and was not officially recognized at this school. There were harsh rules against it, and a cadet caught practicing was kicked out without mercy. But David, like all true geniuses, paid only pragmatic attention to rules made by other people. He obeyed the 11th commandment and never got caught. While other cadets sought the empty prestige of sneaking girls into the barracks or went over the walls at night in search of girls, David kept his activities quiet. Only those who knew him well knew how industriously he pursued this one-body contact sport. And no one knew him well. "Eh? Female cadets? Didn't I make that plain, Ira?" Not only were there no girl cadets, there was not one girl in that Navy except for a few nurses. Most particularly, there were no girls at that school. There were guards night and day to keep them away from the cadets. Don't ask me why. It was Navy policy and therefore did not have a reason. In truth, there was no job in that entire Navy which could not have been performed by either sex or even by eunuchs. But by long tradition, that Navy was exclusively male. Come to think about it, a few years later that tradition was questioned. A little at first, then by the end of that century, shortly before the collapse, the Navy had females at all levels. I'm not suggesting that this change was a cause of the collapse. There were obvious causes of the collapse, causes I won't go into now. This change either was a null factor, or possibly postponed the inevitable by a minor amount. Either way, it doesn't figure into the tale of the lazy man. When David was in school, cadets were supposed to encounter females, but seldom, and only under highly stylized circumstances, rigidly bound protocols, and heavily chaperoned. Instead of fighting the rules, David looked for loopholes and made use of them. He was never caught.